group relations on an international sphere. This year, the theme of the meeting will be Africa, America, New Horizons in Education. We think this is particularly appropriate this year with the many countries which have joined the United Nations during this last 12 months. If the present administration is going to carry through its Peace Corps, which has been announced, I think all of us feel that the type of education that the children get here at Downtown Community School and at other schools where there is a good deal of stress placed on inter-ethnic and inter-racial, inter-educational problems, I think that all of the children that are trained in such schools will perhaps be able to do a very able job and will be very grateful for the type of education they've had when America really gets down to working in this very important international field, which has been going on now, as you are all aware, for some 8 or 9 years, with a 0.4 effort. This 0.4 effort has to certainly be greatly enlarged in scope, and I, for one, certainly hope that the Peace Corps and other international movements of this type get underway. I think all of us feel that it is only through intergroup education and through the experience that children have in solving common problems and having a common experience together that this is most important of all in training adults to work together. Frequently, upon arriving at adulthood, it's really too late to unlearn many of our earlier habits, many of our earlier attitudes and behaviors towards other people different than ourselves. And it is most important, I think, for us not only to have an empathy and an understanding of the other individual living in our society as perhaps a member of a minority group or of another racial group, but to go beyond that. I think that we must be able to understand the individual in terms of his own society and in terms of his own cultural background if we are going to make progress in international relations. So this year we feel especially fortunate in having with us Dr. Skinner, Dr. Elliot Skinner of New York University. Many of you may know him from his Sunrise semester lectures on CBS television, a series that he has been conducting on African cultures during this last year. Mr. Skinner has worked in the field in both British Guiana on race relations and worked in what is now the Upper Volta Republic with the Mosi people in Africa on problems of occupational mobility. It's a great pleasure to welcome this evening Dr. Elliot Skinner.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lear. I would like to thank you for having invited me to talk to this very interesting group about some of the problems which a group of American students faced last summer. Now, this group is called Operations Crossroads Africa. And Operations Crossroads Africa started really as an idea by Dr. James H. Robinson of the Morningside Community Center and the Church of the Masters in Manhattan. Now, Dr. Robinson went through Africa in 1954 and saw some of the changes taking place at that time. He felt that Africa was at a crossroads and that it would be a very good opportunity for young Americans who would have to live in a world in which they would have to meet young Africans as their equals to get a chance to go into Africa and meet Africans face to face and work with them. The first project went to Africa in 1958, taking 60 students and going to three areas, Ghana, Nigeria, and the Cameroons. That first trip was a great success, and later on, in 1960, Dr. Robinson decided to enlarge his project and took to Africa 180 students into 10 countries, and the 180 students were divided into 10 into 15 groups. So you had 180 students divided into 15 groups going into 10 countries. These countries were Senegal, Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, Liberia, Ghana, Togoland, Dahomey, Nigeria, and the Cameroons. We had planned to send two groups into the Congo, but the situation there was not appropriate for that kind of project, so the result was that these groups did not go into the Congo. Now, what are some of the things that we look for in terms of choosing the students to go into Africa? How did we see the project in relationship to Africa and in relationship to the students who applied to go to Africa? First of all, we had a good opportunity to choose wisely and well, because about 600 students applied and we could only take 180. So we were able to weed out those students who we felt were interested, one, in a safari, who we felt were interested in fighting ideological battles, and students who we felt could not relate to Africans as individuals. We were able to take students from almost all parts of the country and from all racial groups. Most of the students, however, did come from colleges, although we did take a few students who were high school graduates and who people who were not in college. So therefore, we had a sample made up of young Americans between the ages of 19 and around 30 in the full flower of youth, interested in Africa and willing then to take upon themselves the task of living under pretty simple conditions and using African food, and in a sense exposing themselves to many of the problems which people face when they go into different cultures, whether the culture is England, France, or Africa. Now, some of the things we tried to impress upon the students were the following. One, we felt that Americans have to understand Africa in terms of Africa of 1960. The stereotypes which we had inherited from the past were not going to work. Secondly, we had to learn to receive information from Africans about themselves and about their aspirations for their country and for the lives of their population. Thirdly, having learned, then the idea was to interact with these students, exchange ideas, so that a common understanding can be reached about the nature of man, if that can be reached by two groups interacting. But at least, if there was a disagreement, individuals would understand the reason for the disagreement rather than not understand why they were disagreeing with each other. Now, what are some of the problems we met in the Ivory Coast? First of all, we found that the idea of a group of Americans coming to Africa to help Africans or to work with Africans was not understood. And the question is, why should it be understood? If one asks oneself about the history of Africa, one finds that most of the people who have gone to Africa before have gone to Africa ostensibly to help Africans. They've wanted, initially, they wanted slaves. Next, they wanted palm oil. Then they wanted areas for markets, areas on which to plant their flags. And in the final analysis, they wanted the souls of the Africans. So the Africans were justifiably suspicious of individuals who came to their country wanting to make friends. They felt that there was something back of this. Now, this was very interesting because we were shocked by this idea. Most of the students felt that they had left America voluntarily. Most of them had paid $850 towards the cost of the project, and they felt that the Africans should have welcomed them. This was not the case. We found that we had to really show time and time again what we were interested in Africa, and only then did some Africans believe that we were not agents of the State Department. Now, this raises many interesting questions from the point of view of Americans working in Africa. Namely, that Americans have a very strange idea that they are private citizens over and against and somehow opposed to their government in many ways. But what one finds is that an American outside of America takes on many of the onuses, shall we say, of his home country. One cannot avoid being an American when one leaves America. One is part and parcel of America. In a sense, one is responsible for America. And even if in this country we feel that we have no voice in our affairs, the Africans will quote to us, government by the people, etc. And if we say that we are not responsible, then they question the very nature of our constitution and of our democracy. Now, once we had established contact, the question came as to what kind of project we would perform in Africa. Groups in different countries did different sorts of things. Some built schools, as we did. Some built roads. Some worked in hospitals. Some worked with missionary bodies. And some just taught children the basic skills. We had a choice of building a soccer field or building a school. We chose the latter because we felt that education was very important in the lives of young children and the life of a young nation such as the Ivory Coast was. Now, in terms of our living arrangements, here we came face to face with certain stereotypes about American life. The boys were given a local school, a lycée, but the Frenchman who was assistant to the Minister of Education could not see American girls living in a schoolroom. So he placed us in a hotel. The result was that after 2 or 3 days, the cost of the hotel was so great that we decided that whether he liked it or not, we would move the girls into the lycée. Finally, we made a compromise and obtained a house from Texaco people in which we housed the girls, thus compromising between our own funds, the ideas of the French and the Africans about the standard of living in America, and the kind of expectations the students had about their life as members of Crossroads. Now, in terms of the relationship with the Africans. Now, the students in our group wanted to meet college students. We found, however, that most of the college students in the Ivory Coast were in France, and when they did come home sometime in August, they would go into their own villages, remain there for 2 or 3 weeks before going back to France to study for exams and so on. So therefore, in the Ivory Coast, we did not meet and get a chance to talk to college students. The students we met were mainly from the lycée, but given the educational situation in many parts of Africa, one finds in the lycée individuals from about 14 to as old as 20. So we did meet individuals of the ages of our students, and we were able then to have all sorts of discussions with them. Now, the people in the villages were very kind to us. They didn't quite trust us at first, but then the Americans won their hearts by eating fufu, which is a local food. I forgot to warn the chief about the taste of the Americans. The result was the first time we got there, the food was good, but it was too hot. There was too much pepper. The girls didn't want to eat it especially, but I looked stern. The result was that they ate it and used a great deal of water. But after I told the chief that, well, we liked the food and everything, but the next time don't put as much pepper as you did. So in time then, our relationship with the villagers became quite friendly, and we were received by almost all of the people in the village with open arms. Now, so in terms of working arrangements, things went fairly well. But one of the things that we found was that we had created a stir in the Ivory Coast. The Minister of Education, for example, made a big thing of all coming to the Ivory Coast, and we discovered, to our horror, that all coming to the Ivory Coast fitted into the plans of the Minister of Education to modify some of the existing youth groups. Now, those of you who have been following the political development in Africa know that the Africans are centralizing most of their institutions. They had inherited from the French about three types of scouts: the Protestant scouts, the Catholic scouts, and a group of scouts call themselves the Light Bringers to Africa. But these young people were competing among themselves and were not doing too much towards building their country. Our presence in the Ivory Coast enabled the Minister of Education to say to the three groups, look, these American students are here to help us build our country. Enough of this scouting. Go and help them work. Now again, I was placed in the position of having to, in a sense, act as an intermediary between the French people who were leading these scout troops and the Minister of Education. The compromise I came to was to tell the French scout leaders to bring their people to the work camp. Then I took half of the people to work with me and allow half of the people to work as being good scouts. In this way, then, I compromised between the Minister of Education, who was interested in centralization in terms of youth activities, and also the French people who were there who were interested in certain activities. But one of the problems we faced as a group, a mixed group of Americans, was in the realm of race relations. And here I would say that I learned a great deal about the nature of race relations in America, in Africa. In a sense, I learned more about race relations there than I learned about race relations here. Of course, I had taught courses in race relations, but I taught courses to people who, again, were almost believers, you see, true believers. What I found out in Africa is that, by and large, there wasn't too much contact between whites and Negroes in the United States. Not too much contact on an individual basis, of course. People did have all sorts of notions about each other, and these notions were fortified and strengthened by a lack of contact. But having Americans, both white and colored, trying to answer the questions of the Africans about the nature of race relations usually created all sorts of arguments between the Americans themselves. So in a sense, before Americans could really explain to Africans the nature of race relations in the United States, the Americans had to work out and understand the nature of race relations for themselves. Not only this, I was able to see how Americans of European origin reacted to situations in which they were members of minority groups. Now, this was a very fascinating thing to me because I'd never seen it. I was in Africa in 55 to 57. But at that time, the Europeans were numerically in the minority, but in terms of power, they were dominant. I had never seen in my whole life Europeans in a minority position. Those American students who found themselves in minority positions for the first time reacted in a way which was not too different from the way in which American Negroes had always reacted to being members of a minority group. That's in a sense, it was in Africa then that both Negroes and whites did understand some of the problems which we have to face in our own society if we will relate to Africans in their own society. Now, race relations was one interesting area in which there's a great deal of conflict and a great deal of talking and a great deal of resolution of problems. But we did have other types of questions, and the second question might amuse you. The Africans were very interested in the Chessman case. They could not understand for the life of them why Chessman was killed. We were held guilty for Chessman having been killed. We couldn't explain that Chessman was in California. California was a sovereign state, and some of us were against Chessman being executed. They felt that there was something about the American character which was out of order. After a man had been in jail for so long, they thought it was very cruel for the man to be killed. So again, this is a very interesting area because it does give you some idea of how the Africans look at Americans. And in some of the most unexpected areas, you find a great deal of feeling and emotion. Now, the third area in which we had a great deal of questions and problems was in the area of Algeria. Algeria was a very sore point, and somehow we could not really explain America's position. The Africans were asking us to choose, and we spoke in terms of commitments and so on, and they were not quite clear about this or sure that we were right. And the Africans have a very interesting kind of logic here. They could understand, for example, we explained about all commitments and so on, but they couldn't explain, they couldn't understand, well, if we were sincere, well, why we had to give arms to the French, why the Algerians had to be killed with bullets furnished by America. They could understand then having to support France in the abstract for political reasons, but they couldn't understand really why American guns and bullets had to be used. And again, this is difficult for us, for many Americans, to understand. But getting back to the whole question of America and Americans in a strange country, and even how the role of an individual American is ultimately tied up to the role of his government, can be understood if we, again, look at some of the experiences of our group. For example, we tried to convince the Africans for a long time that we had paid our own money to go there and help build a school. Just about the time that we had gotten them convinced, two things happened which really shook everyone up in terms of the kind of pictures we had built for ourselves. For example, just before we got ready to leave, the USIS people came in. They came in with their cameras, they came in with their tape recorders, and in a sense, the whole arm of the State Department came in and almost took over the project. Now, the Africans began to ask questions like this. Now, if you people are private, who are these people here? Why are they here? Why are they taking pictures? For what purpose are they taking pictures? Isn't this something that you people are doing for your own government? Again, how do you answer this question? The answer is yes and the answer is no. But is that enough? Aren't we as Americans part of our own governmental system? Aren't we tied up to our government? If so, shouldn't we then bear the onus when our government creates a problem overseas? And shouldn't we then be congratulated when our government does a good job? I think we ought to be. I think we are part of our government, and that there's something wrong, I feel, when people can feel that they are separated from their government and what they do has nothing at all to do with what their government does. Now, another thing happened which was very interesting, but again, but shows some of the problems one meets in Africa, is the American Charge of the Affairs, a very nice fellow, in contrast to what you hear about American State Department personnel, he and his wife put on dungarees and came out to our project to help us. Now, this man felt that he was being a good neighbor. Here were some Americans doing a job, and he was going to help them. But again, no one in the project could see this man in any other role as against his role as the Charge of the Affairs. So when it was written up, it was not written up as the American who works in the consulate came down to help other Americans. It was written up as the Charge of the Affairs of the United States went to help other American students build a school for the children of the Ivory Coast. Thus, in a way then, although we saw ourselves as private citizens, and although even the governmental officials there, when they worked with us, saw themselves as private citizens, the people of the country saw all of us doing whatever we did do as parts of America. The moral here is, and it's a moral from which we can't escape, whatever we do in this country, despite north, south, east, or west, is seen as the action of Americans and America. We just can't get away from it. We are faced with this problem, and the problem is, I think, is that we cannot convince, and we will not convince other people to the contrary. Thus, in a sense, in order to interrelate, to meet these people, we have to make changes which sometimes I despair of Americans being able to make in time to meet some of the real problems that they will face in Africa. The problem is ours. We have to face it because there are other forces in the world which are working just as hard as we are to make friends and influence people. It's our problem. The people, they are students who went with Crossroads, tried to do a job, and in a sense they did a good job, as I'll show you in the slides, which I'll show to you in a few minutes. America has to be behind them. They must be supported by all of us. If not, the individual acts of Americans will not amount to very much if these acts are not seen and supported by other Americans, so that the image of America can be an image, a coherent image, and not an image filled with many contradictions. Now, I think you want to show the slides first, and then I'll answer any questions you may have about this.
They don't have anybody. I'm just the only one now.
Mm-hmm. In the old days, did they hunt with the bows and arrows?
They used a lot of bow and arrows and different rocks, you know. Mm-hmm. To make slings.
What kind of animals have they hunted? Are there small animals besides deer and things?
Those little birds, what do you call them? Quail?
Quail? Uh-huh.
They do a lot of eating. Quail.
Are there raccoon? Do you know? Raccoon and different other small
birds. My little friend is a god. Two years in your two years. My parents in the old days, they ate those, but it was, I just don't care for them, we never had them.
Now, did they do any agriculture? I'm sorry, Jim, go ahead.
What are the important foods?
Yeah, you're so.
We
like rabbits quite a bit. We like rabbit meat.
But what are the main foods that they live on?
You mean wild?
Corn,
and this corn, and
beans,
and squash.
Would they like to have animals too? I mean, domestic animals, you know?
We'd like to have it, but we just don't have it.
Can they take care of them if they get them, do they feel?
We'd like to have mother to take care of them.
You weaken the show, then you have to come tomorrow.
I noticed the huts that the families live in, and they seem to be very open to the elements. You know, rain can come in. Mm-hmm. How do they keep dry and how do they keep warm here?
There's nothing that'll keep us dry, so we just stay wet and get dry the best way we can.
Yes, in this particular ramada in which we're sitting, I noticed that you can see whether the stars are out when you look up at the roof.
I know that you just wonder how we live, but we just have to do the best we can.
Has there ever been any insanity here since she has known of this? She knows the word, though?
Yes.
She knows the word? How did you describe the word?
I asked them, do you know, like, sick, and, you know,
in
just sick in the head? That's the only way I can ask it.
Loretta, how old are the young people in your tribe before they're considered to be adults and they can take the responsibilities of a grown-up person?
I can't tell you by numbers, but it's the latest when they, so that's the only way I can tell you. I can't tell you numbers.
Is there a ceremony that takes place at the time when they become men and women, you know?
He says, yes, in my day, because we did when a lady becomes a lady, so we used to have a ceremony where we buried them, you know.
No more of them?
For 4 days, not anymore.
You buried them?
They dug the ground and they buried them for 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
4 days, 4 nights, I think. They bring them out every morning.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Just up to their heads, or?
They just dug a deep, you know, I don't know how far down, but they just lay them in there. They put hot stones in there, and then they dip different kinds of herbs.
Does she think that it was a mistake to give up these ceremonies of the way they did things in the old days?
He says, well, in the olden days we had to do those things. Now, he says, we just don't practice anymore, so he says, it's just dying out.
There's none at all? What about in the case of a death? Is there a ceremony to the Indian gods in the case of a death?
Yes, we do. Yes, we keep night and day and sing, you know, in our own way.
In the old days, there was supposed to be a punishment for not doing these things. Is this?
Yes.
Not, does she feel that there has been a sort of an unwise thing to discontinue the old patterns?
In the olden days, he said, yes, it's different, because in the olden days we had to do those things, but now he says we don't have to.
Why did they have to do them? What does she mean?
I believe that we had to live by, he said, that thought those days that they purified the girls, you know, where they could live a long life and don't have wrinkles on their face and no gray hair. He says, all those things that we did, it was a good thing. But he says, now, he says, I can't even talk to these young ones about it.
Did Loretta go through this ceremony when she was a girl?
Yes, they done that to me.
Well, then that's why she doesn't have any gray hair.
He said, maybe that's why he says my hair is black, because I know.
Why do the young girls and boys today, why don't they believe in these things?
They won't even let me do it.
Does she think they should be punished?
I won't even try. He says, I got tired of preaching to them. I said, I gave up years now.
It worked pretty good for her, though. They don't think it'll work for them?
So they don't want to listen to me, so that's their life.
I think we should let Loretta get under the fire.
You want to get
thank
that
her
fire,
so
Loretta.
Much for us.
Thank you very much. Tell her she's a wonderful woman.
I'm sure glad he thinks so. He says,
tell her in our culture people would listen to her.
She might shock the people.
No.
She's a wise woman.
Hunger is the great fear of the Komi, but there's another great fear as well, the shapeless and undefined mystery of the outside world. The following discussion with a woman of the Komi deals with a great tragedy which has befallen the tribe this year, a tragedy that is discussed at the campfires each night.
This is Mrs. Eleonora Matakayes. Yes. How old are you, Mrs. Kayes?
I'm 2 years old. some time. 50 years, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Calles, we know that you have a son named Alberto, and that a very upsetting thing has happened with him in the last few months. Would you tell us about what happened with your son?
I feel so bad. I look for my son every day.
What happened to her son?
I don't know, but he went across, and then from there they took him somewhere, and from this day I don't know where he's at.
Let me perhaps fill in a little bit. Last April 9th, according to the information that I have, Alberto Mesa Calles crossed the line into Southern California. He went by Indian trails, and he had no proper papers, and as is the custom among the Indians in these hills, there's a great deal of passing back and forth. Alberto was apprehended by United States officials and was taken to, first of all, to the Imperial Valley and kept there for a couple of weeks, then was taken down into Texas to a town called Harlingen, from where he was unceremoniously dumped across the border into Mexico. My impression is that, or let's ask Mrs. Mesa Calles whether her son speaks any English.
No, he doesn't speak one word English.
And does he speak very much Spanish?
He doesn't even know how to speak Spanish but a few words.
Now, U.S. records show that Alberto was put over into Mexico on May 9th, and I'd like to ask Mrs. Mesa Calles whether she has heard from him at all since then.
I haven't heard one word about him, or nobody has come to me and told me anything as yet.
Well, the place in Mexico, Matamoros, where he was sent across the line, is approximately 1,000 miles away from the Valley of Nehi, where we are now. Has she been able to contact the Mexican authorities, or has anyone started any procedures for recovering her son?
He says, I went to the Mexican authority and says, remember that the last time I went with you, that was
right. Yes.
And he said, and I went again, he said, and they kept telling me the same thing. They haven't had no answers. So I just don't know what to think.
Mrs. Florence Shipek, an anthropologist affiliated with the San Diego Science Foundation, has been studying the Komi'i intensively for several months.
Mr. Shipek, you've told us that there used to be 4,000 Komi'i. Now there are less than 100. Could you give us a brief historical description of their decline? Why did it happen?
The beginning of their decline started, of course, with the arrival of the Spanish. The Spanish brought them into missions. To a certain extent, not all of these people came into the mission, but those who did come into the mission brought back to the people the diseases that they picked up in the mission. And there were things like measles, to which the Indians were not accustomed, the common cold, influenza. There were many diseases to which they as people had never acquired any immunity, and as a result, these diseases wiped them out. Disease did more than warfare or anything else in wiping out the people.
I noticed they were, I would describe them as rather passive in their relationships with us. Were they at one time an aggressive people?
No, these people were never extremely aggressive, if in that sense you're thinking of the type of aggressiveness that the Plains Indians had and some of the East Coast Indians. These people were always more on the passive side, but they were also an individualistic type of person. They did not stay in a large group together. They spread out in their little village family groups.
And did they have war experiences?
They had war experiences, yes, but it was more on the defensive than offensive type of war experience. During the 1830s, there were several minor skirmishes where they attacked a few outlying ranches and that sort of thing. But in a belated attempt to get rid of the white man. But
well,
it was a little too late.
Food gatherers are, as a rule, passive and peaceful people.
That's right.
They have to be spread out in order to find their food.
They have to spend a major portion of their time searching for food in order to acquire enough to feed the family.
And since they're not hunters, essentially, they weren't also warriors.
That's right.
Well, there was a question that I would like to raise in reference to the leader of the tribe, the old woman, Loretta, who seemed to be such a dominant woman as to be almost tyrannical, what would we call it, a benevolent tyrant. And she seemed to have taken the starch out of Mata, her son, and who doesn't have, apparently, leadership qualities that this tribe needs at this time, whatever there is left. And there was another part of this problem which indicates that Loretta will not allow any of the people to leave the tribe or doesn't want them to. She discourages every move away from them. And in asking the young girl what she'll do about marriage, she apparently is resigned to the fact that she's going to remain single. Now, how can, on the one hand, now here I'll pose the question. On the one hand, how can a tribe exist unless they bring new children into the world and marry? And on the other hand, how can they exist if they have to go away from this area in order to find their mate?
I think Loretta is expressing her desires, and yet at the same time, I think she's realizes that the people are going to have to search amongst other people for their husbands and wives, and that they are doing it. Apparently, now they didn't say so or didn't bring it out down there, but two or three of them have gone out and gone searching for mates elsewhere. Now, there's one particular marriage I know that took place at, down in Tecate there with they're related Indians in that they're human-speaking Indians, but they're not of that particular band. Not of that clan, and they are married down in Tecate, and they have a small place in Tecate, so that they are going to gradually intermarry.
Don't you think that Loretta was accepting this partially when she said she wishes that they would learn Spanish and English? She was accepting the fact that there's going to have to be
she
contact.
Has a real ambivalence about
I think she wants to protect them for what she apparently anticipates are the difficulties and yet wants them to get the advantage.
In fact, I could almost visualize Loretta sending out a little raiding party to capture, the needed number of men and bring them back to Komi'ai and keep them there. That's the sort of solution that would appeal to her.
Well, she's really a torn person now. Intelligence would make her want to face the new
Everyone else feel she was tremendously intelligent?
The primitive, it's a battle with, I imagine that the whole battle is being fought out in her breast in a sense, the battle between trying to accept the frightening thing and realizing that the desire to stick with the old traditional way is not adequate.
That's
she
right.
Certainly also showed doubt as to the ability of Mata as her leader and the chief who would follow.
I have the feeling that she has been so dominant in most matters that she hasn't given any of the others a chance to really try their wings.
Yes, this is a very good point.
Always a powerful leader.
That's right. And I have the feeling that when she goes that someone will step into her place. It might not necessarily
sort of a natural
be
selection.
The Julian, as a mentioned up there, was the
captain.
He's the son of the former captain.
Oh.
And he should logically be given a chance to try out as captain.
He said that technically he's captain.
Yeah. but that
by right of inheritance.
He apparently was traveled away from there for a while, and when he came back, they weren't sure that they could accept him as their captain. And it's sort of in that loose situation now as to whether he's going to become captain or not. And of course, the other thing is that these people have always had a tremendous respect for the aged, and Loretta, as a result, gets this respect.
She's a character out of a Greek tragedy.
She's certainly a tremendously impressive personality.
It's a great tragedy facing these people, and she realizes it because in talking with them, I have discovered that just less than 60 years ago, say 40 years ago even, there were Indians throughout that whole territory, and they have gradually died off.
You told me that there was a child death by starvation within the last year.
Yes, that's correct.
And all this within 100 miles of San Diego, and the most advanced...
Much less than 100 miles.
This is less,
Diego,
this
yeah.
less than 100 miles.
And here we are, the most advanced civilization, and the apparently civilization out of the Stone Age. Within.
That's correct. It's very sad.
What do you think the chances of the Komi are, Mrs. Shipwright?
They seem hopeful themselves. And I feel that with a little aid, that their chances of survival will be good. But I don't think they will survive as a tribe. They will gradually spread out and intermarry and lose their tribal identity.
The program you have just heard was made possible because some qualified person was willing to spend long hours writing, preparing, and recording it for WBAI and Pacifica Radio. This person received no pay for his efforts. His compensation came simply in the knowledge that his efforts would be heard by the best radio audience in the world, that select group which believes in the power of radio to stimulate, educate, and entertain with complete freedom from commercial or other outside pressure. This is the principle along which WBAI plans its 16-hour program day. WBAI is free radio, the kind of broadcasting which has won the respect and admiration of broadcasters around the world. It is up to you, the WBAI audience, to prove that this kind of radio is needed and valued today. You can do this with your subscription to WBAI, listener-supported radio. Subscriptions to the station are $12 a year, more if you can afford it. We need your support now. Please send your check today to WBAI, New York 16.
And this is listener-supported radio, WBAI 99.5 megacycles in New York. The preceding program, a documentary on the Komi people, was produced by members of the staff and volunteers at KPFK in Los Angeles. The time now, 12 and a half minutes before 9 p.m. At 9 o'clock, we'll present the sixth in the current series of concerts from the Coolidge Auditorium of the Library of Congress, the Budapest Quartet with the pianist Eugene Istomin in performances of quartets and quintets by Mozart, Beethoven, and Dvorak. From now until then, Renaissance and Baroque music for the guitar as performed by Carl Scheidt. Thank you. You've heard the guitarist Carl Scheidt in performances of Prämel by Neusiedler, Pavana by Milan, Fantasia by Weissel, and the Galliard, The King of Denmark by John Dowland. This is listener-supported radio, WBAI 99.5, on your FM dial in New York. We present the sixth in a series of concerts from the Library of Congress, recorded by station WGMS at the Coolidge Auditorium and presented under the auspices of the Gertrude Clark Whitall Foundation. On this evening's program, we shall hear music by Mozart, Beethoven, and Dvorak, performed by the Budapest Quartet with Eugene Stoman, pianist. We hear first the Piano Quartet in G Minor, Kirkel 478 by Mozart. The performance is by the pianist Eugene Stoman with Joseph Reusmann, Boris Kreut, and Misha Schneider of the Budapest Quartet.
Thank you. Thank you.